now, even though she knew that Lavrans would regain his full health, and that Ulviel would survive. Fru Asil seemed to enjoy talking to Kristin, and for each day that passed, the maiden became better friends with her. One day, when they had gone out to pick herbs, they sat down next to the river in a little grassy clearing at the foot of a scree. They could look down at the courtyard of Formo and see Arne Geirdsson's red shirt. He had ridden over with them and was going to look after their horses while they were up in the mountain meadow gathering herbs. As they sat there, Kristin told Fru Asiel about her encounter with the dwarf maiden. She hadn't thought about the incident for many years, but now it suddenly came back to her. And as she spoke, the strange thought occurred to her that there was some resemblance between Fru Asiel and the dwarf woman, even though she realized full well that they did not look at all alike. But when she finished telling the story, Fru Asiel sat in silence for a moment and gazed out across the valley. Finally, she said, "It was wise of you to flee, since you were only a child back then. But haven't you ever heard of people who took the gold the dwarf offered them, and then trapped the troll in a rock afterward?"
"I've heard of such stories," said Kristin, "but I would never dare do that myself. And I don't think it's the right thing to do."
"It's good when you don't dare do something that doesn't seem right," said Fru Asiel with a little laugh, "but it's not so good if you think something isn't right because you don't dare do it." Then she added abruptly, "You've grown up a great deal this summer. I wonder if you realize how lovely you've become."
"Yes, I know," said Kristin. "They say I look like my father."
Fru Asiel laughed softly. "Yes, it would be best if you took after Lavrans, both in temperament and appearance. And yet it would be a shame if they married you to someone up here in the valley. Farming customs and the ways of smallholders should not be disdained, but these gentry up here all think they're so grand that their equals are not to be found in all of Norway. I'm sure they wonder how I can manage to live and prosper even though they've closed their doors to me. But they're lazy and arrogant and refuse to learn new ways. And then they blame everything on the old enmity with the monarchy in the time of King Sveira. It's all a lie. Your ancestor reconciled with King Sveira and accepted gifts from him. But if your mother's brother wanted to serve the king and join his retinue, then he would have to cleanse himself both inside and out, which is not something Tron is willing to do. But you, Kristin, you ought to marry a man who is both chivalrous and courtly." Kristin sat staring down at the Formo courtyard, at Arna's red back. She hadn't been aware of it herself, but whenever Fru Asiel talked about the world she had frequented in the past, Kristin always pictured the knights and counts in Arna's image. "My nephew, Arlen Nikolausen of Huseby, now he would have been a suitable bridegroom for you. He has grown up to be so handsome, that boy. My sister Manyel came to visit me last year when she was on her way through the valley, and she brought her son along with her. Well, you won't be able to marry him, of course, but I would have gladly spread the blanket over the two of you in the wedding bed. His hair is as dark as yours is fair, and he has beautiful eyes. But if I know my brother-in-law, he has already set his sights on a better match for Ireland than you would be."
"Does that mean I'm not a good match, then?" asked Kristin with surprise. She was never offended by anything Fru Asiel said, but she felt embarrassed and chagrined that Fru Asiel might be somehow better than her own family.
"Yes, of course you're a good match," said Fru Asiel. "And yet you couldn't expect to become part of my lineage. Your ancestor here in Norway was an outlaw and a foreigner, and the Yeslings have sat moldering away on their estates for such a long time that almost no one remembers them outside of this valley. But my sister and I married the nephews of Queen Margaret School's daughter." Kristin didn't even think to object that it was not her ancestor but his brother who had come to Norway as an outlaw.
She sat and gazed out over the dark mountain slopes across the valley, and she remembered that day, many years ago, when she went up onto the ridge and saw how many mountains there were between her own village and the rest of the world. Then Fru Asiel said they ought to head home, and she asked Kristen to call for Arna. Kristen put her hands up to her mouth and shouted, and then waved her kerchief until she saw the red speck down in the courtyard turn and wave back. Sometime later, Fru Asiel returned home, but during the fall and the first part of winter, she often came to Jurengard to spend a few days with Ulvil. The child was now taken out of bed in the daytime, and they tried to get her to stand on her own, but her legs crumpled beneath her whenever she tried it. She was fretful, pale, and tired, and the laced garment that Fru Asiel had made for her from horsehide and slender willow branches plagued her terribly. All she wanted to do was lie in her mother's lap. Ronfrid was constantly holding her injured daughter, so Tordis was now in charge of all the housekeeping. At her mother's request, Kristen accompanied Tordis to help and to learn. Kristen sometimes longed for Fru Asiel, who occasionally would talk to her a great deal. But at other times, Kristen would wait in vain for a word beyond the casual greeting as Fru Asiel came and went. Instead, Fru Asiel would sit with the grown-ups and talk. That was always what happened when she brought her husband along with her, for now Bjorn Gunnarsson also came to Jurengard. One day in the fall, Lavrans had ridden over to Haugen to take Fru Asiel payment for her doctoring, the best silver pitcher and matching platter they owned. He had stayed the night and afterward had high praise for their farm. He said it was beautiful and well-tended, and not as small as people claimed. Inside the buildings, everything looked prosperous, and the customs of the house were as courtly as those of the gentry in the south of the country. What Lavrans thought of Björn he didn't say, but he always received the man courteously when Björn accompanied his wife to Jurengard. On the other hand, Lavrans was exceedingly fond of Fru Asiel, and he believed that most of what people said about her was a lie. He also said that 20 years earlier, she would hardly have required witchcraft to bind a man to her. She was 60 now, but still looked young, and she had a most appealing and charming manner. Kristen noticed that her mother was not happy about all this. It's true that Ronfrid never said much about Fru Asiel, but one time she compared Björn to the flattened yellow grass that can be found under large rocks, and Kristen thought this an apt description. Björn had an oddly faded appearance. He was quite fat, pale and sluggish, and slightly bald, even though he was not much older than Lavrans. And yet it was still apparent that he had once been an extremely handsome man. Kristen never exchanged a single word with him. He said little, preferring to stay in one spot, wherever he happened to be seated, from the moment he stepped in the door until it was time for bed. He drank an enormous amount, but it seemed to have little effect on him. He ate almost nothing, and occasionally he would stare at someone in the room, stony-faced and pensive, with his strange, pale eyes. They had not seen their kinsman from Sundbu since the accident occurred, but Lavrans had been over to Voga several times. Sira Eirik, on the other hand, came to Jurengard as often as before, and there he frequently met Fru Asiel. They had become good friends. People thought this a generous attitude on the part of the priest, since he himself was a very capable doctor. This was also probably one of the reasons why people on the large estates had not sought Fru Asiel's advice, at least not openly, because they considered the priest to be competent enough. It was not easy for them to know how to act toward two people who in some ways had been cast out of their own circles. Sira Eirik himself said that they caused no one any harm, and as for Fru Asiel's witchcraft, he was not her parish priest. It could be that the woman knew more than was good for the health of her soul, And yet one should not forget that ignorant people often spoke of witchcraft as soon as a woman showed herself to be wiser than the councilman. For her part, Fru Ashiel spoke highly of the priest and diligently went to church if she happened to be at Urengard on a holy day. Christmas was a sad time that year. Ulvil was still unable to stand on her own, and they neither saw nor heard from their kinsmen at Sundbu. Kristin noticed that people in the village were talking about the rift and that her father took it to heart. But her mother didn't care, and Kristin thought this was callous of her. One evening, toward the end of the holidays, Sira Sigurd, Trond Yesling's house priest, arrived in a big sleigh, and his primary mission was to invite them all to visit Sundbu. Sira Sigurd was not well-liked in the surrounding villages, for he was the one who actually managed Trond's properties for him, or at least he was the one who was blamed whenever Trond acted harshly or unjustly, and Trond tended to plague his tenants somewhat. The priest was exceedingly clever at writing and figuring. He knew the law and was a skilled doctor, although not as skilled as he thought. But judging by his behavior, no one would think him a clever man. He often said foolish things. Ranfrid and Lavrans had never liked him, but the Sundbu people, as was reasonable, set great store by their priest, and both they and he were greatly disappointed that he had not been called on to tend to Ulvil. On the day that Sira Sigurd came to Urengard, unfortunately for him, Fru Ashiel and Herr Bjørn were already there, as were Sira Eirik, Arna's parents Geird and Inga of Finnsbrekken, old Jon from Loptsgard, and a friar from Hamar, brother Oskout. While Ranfrid had the table set once more with food for the guests, and Lavrans pored over the boxes of sealed letters that the priest had brought, Sira Sigurd asked to see Ulvil. She had already been put to bed for the night and was sleeping, but Sira Sigurd woke her up, examined her back and limbs, and asked her questions. At first, kindly enough, but with increasing impatience as Ulvil grew frightened. Sigurd was a small man, practically a dwarf, but he had a big, flame-red face. When he tried to lift her onto the floor to test her legs, Ulvil began to scream. Then Fru Ashiel stood up, went over to the bed, and covered her with a blanket, saying that the child was sleepy. She wouldn't have been able to stand up even if her legs were healthy. The priest began to protest vehemently. He was also considered a capable doctor. But Fru Ashiel took his hand, led him over to the high seat at the table, and started talking about what she had done for Ulvil as she asked his opinion on everything. Then he grew more amenable, and he ate and drank of Ranfrid's good repast. But when the ale and wine began to go to his head, Sira Sigurd was once again in a foul mood, quarrelsome and bad-tempered. He was quite aware that no one in the room liked him. First he turned to Geird, who was the envoy of the Bishop of Hamar at Vaga, and Sil. There had been numerous disputes between the bishopric and Trond Iverson. Geird didn't say much, but Inga was a hot-tempered woman, and then Brother Oskut joined in the discussion. He said, "You shouldn't forget, Sira Sigurd, that our worthy Father Ingjald is your prelate too. We all know about you and Hamar. You revel in all that is good at Sundbu, and give little thought to the fact that you are dedicated to other work than acting as Trond's eye servant, helping him do everything that is unjust so that he endangers his own soul and diminishes the power of the church. Haven't you ever heard about what happens to those disobedient and unfaithful priests who contravene their own spiritual fathers and superiors? Don't you know about the time when the angels led St. Thomas of Canterbury to the gates of hell and let him peek inside? He was greatly surprised not to see any of those who had opposed him as you oppose your bishop. He was just about to praise God's mercy, for the holy man wished all sinners to be saved, when the angel asked the devil to lift his tail. With a tremendous roar and a horrid stench of sulfur, out spewed all the priests and learned men who had betrayed the interests of the church,
and then he saw where all of them had ended up.
You're lying, monk, said the priest.
I've heard that story too, but it was friars, not priests, who were spewed out of the devil's behind like wasps from a wasp's nest.
Old Jan laughed louder than all the servants and cried,
No doubt it was both. I'll bet it was.
Then the devil must have a very wide tail, said Bjorn Gunnarsson. And Fru Asild smiled and said, Yes. Haven't you heard it said that everything bad has a long rump dragging behind?
You be quiet, Fru Asil, shouted Sira Sigurd. You shouldn't talk about the long rump that bad people drag behind them. Here you sit as if you were mistress of the house instead of Ronfrid.
But it's odd that you haven't been able to cure her child.
Don't you have any more of that powerful water you used to use? The water that could make a dismembered sheep whole again in the soup pot, and turn a woman into a maiden in the bridal bed. I know all about that wedding here in the village when you prepared the bath for the despoiled bride.
Sira Eirik jumped up, grabbed the other priest by the shoulder and flank, and threw him right across the table so that pitchers and cups toppled and food and drink spilled onto the tablecloths and floor. Sira Sigurd landed flat on his back, his clothing torn. Eirik leaped over the table and was about to strike him again, bellowing over the din,
Shut your filthy trap, you damned priest!
Lavrans tried to separate them, but Ronfrid stood at the table, as white as a corpse, wringing her hands. Then Fru Asild ran over and helped Sira Sigurd to his feet and wiped the blood from his face. She handed him a goblet of mead as she said,
You shouldn't be so stern, Sira Eirik, that you can't stand to hear a joke late in the evening after so many drinks. Now sit down, and I'll tell you about that wedding.
It wasn't here in this valley at all, and it's my misfortune that I was not the one who knew about that water. If I had been able to brew it, we wouldn't be sitting up there on that little farm. Then I'd be a rich woman with property out in the big villages somewhere, near the town and cloisters and bishops and canons, she said, smiling at the three clergymen. But someone must have known the art in the old days, because this was in the time of King Inge, as far as I know, and the bridegroom was Peter Lodensen of Bratalan. But I won't say which of his three wives was the bride, since there are living descendants from all three. Well, this bride probably had good reason to wish for that water, and she managed to get it, too. She prepared a bath for herself out in the shed, but before she managed to bathe, in came the woman who was to be her mother-in-law. She was muddy and dirty from the ride to the wedding manor, so she took off her clothes and stepped into the tub. She was an old woman, and she had 9 children by Loden. But on that night, both Loden and Pieter had a different kind of pleasure than they had counted on. Everyone in the room laughed heartily, and both Gerd and Jan called to Fru Asild to tell more such ribald tales. But she refused. Here sit 2 priests, and Brother Oskut, and young boys and maidservants. We should stop now before the talk grows indecent and vulgar. Remember that these are the holy days. The men protested, but the women agreed with Fru Asild. No one noticed that Ronfrid had left the room. A little later, Kristen, who had been sitting at the far end of the women's bench among the maidservants, stood up to go to bed. She was sleeping in Tordis's house because there were so many guests at the farm. It was biting cold, and the northern lights were flaring and flickering above the domed mountains to the north. The snow creaked under Kristen's feet as she ran across the courtyard, shivering, with her arms crossed over her breast. Then she noticed that in the shadows beneath the old loft, someone was pacing vigorously back and forth in the snow, throwing out her arms, wringing her hands, and moaning loudly. Kristen recognized her mother. Frightened, she ran over to her and asked her if she was ill.
No, no. Said Ronfrid fiercely. I just had to get out. Go to bed now, child. Kristen turned around when her mother softly called her name. Go into the house and lie down in bed with your father and Ulvil. Hold her in your arms so that he doesn't crush her by mistake. He sleeps so heavily when he's drunk. I'll go up and sleep here in the old loft tonight.
Jesus, Mother, said Kristen. You'll freeze to death if you sleep there. And all alone? What will Father say if you don't come to bed tonight?
He won't notice, replied her mother. He was almost asleep when I left, and tomorrow he'll get up late. Go and do as I say.
You'll be so cold, whimpered Kristen,
but her mother pushed her away somewhat more gently, and then shut herself inside the loft. It was just as cold inside as out, and pitch dark. Ronfrid fumbled her way over to the bed, tore the shawl from her head, took off her shoes, and crawled under the furs. They chilled her to the bone. It was like sinking into a snowdrift. She pulled the covers over her head, tucked up her legs, and put her hands into the bodice of her clothing. And she lay there in that way, weeping, alternately crying quite softly with streaming tears, and then screaming and gnashing her teeth in between her sobs. Finally, she had warmed up the bed enough that she began to feel drowsy, and then she cried herself to sleep. Chapter 5. In the springtime of Kristen's 15th year, Lavrans Björgofsson and Sir Andres Gudmundsson of Diefrin agreed to meet at Holidus Ting. There they decided that Andres' second son, Simon, should be betrothed to Kristen Lavrans' daughter, and that he would be given Formo, the property which Andres had inherited from his mother. The men sealed the agreement with a handshake, but no document was drawn up about it, because Andres first had to arrange for the inheritance of his other children. And no betrothal ale was drunk either, but Sir Andres and Simon accompanied Lavrans back to Jurengard to see the bride, and Lavrans gave a great banquet. Lavrans had finished building the new house, 2 stories tall, with brick fireplaces in both the main room and the loft. It was richly and beautifully decorated with wood carvings and fine furniture. He had also renovated the old loft and expanded the other buildings so that he could now live in a manner befitting a squire. By this time, he possessed great wealth, for he had been fortunate in his undertakings, and he was a wise and thoughtful master. He was especially known for breeding the finest horses and the best cattle of all types. And now that he had arranged things so that his daughter would acquire Formo through marriage with a man of the Diefrin lineage, people said that he had successfully achieved his goal of becoming the foremost landowner in the village. Lavrans and Ronfrid were also very pleased, as were Sir Andres and Simon. Kristen was a little disappointed when she first saw Simon Andersen, for she had heard such high praise of his handsome appearance and noble manner that there was no limit to what she had expected of her bridegroom. Simon was indeed handsome, but he was rather heavy-set for a man of only 20. He had a short neck, and his face was as round and shiny as the moon. His hair was quite beautiful, brown and curly, and his eyes were gray and clear, but they seemed slightly pinched because his eyelids were puffy. His nose was too small, and his mouth was also small and pouting, but not ugly. And in spite of his stoutness, he was light-footed and quick and agile in all his movements, and he was an able sportsman. He was rather impetuous and rash in his speech, but Lavrans felt that he nevertheless showed both good sense and wisdom when he spoke to older men. Ronfrid soon came to like him, and Ulvil developed at once the greatest affection for him. He was also particularly kind and loving toward the little maiden who was ill. And after Kristen had grown accustomed to his round face and his way of speaking, she was entirely satisfied with her betrothed and pleased that her father had arranged the marriage for her. Fru Ashil was invited to the banquet. Ever since the people of Jurengard had taken up with her, the gentry of the nearest villages had once again begun to remember her high birth, and they paid less attention to her strange reputation. So now, Fru Asiel was often in the company of others. After she had seen Simon, she said, "He's a good match, Kristin. This Simon will do well in the world. You'll be spared many types of sorrow. And he'll be a kind man to live with. But he seems to me rather too fat and cheerful. If things were the same in Norway today as they were in the past, and as they are in other countries, where people are no sterner towards sinners than God is himself, then I would suggest you find yourself a friend who is thin and melancholy, someone you could sit and talk to. Then I would say that you could fare no better than with Simon." Kristin blushed, even though she didn't fully understand what Fru Asiel meant. But as time passed and her dowry chests were filled, and she listened to the constant talk of her marriage and what she would take to her new home, she began to yearn for the matter to be bound with a formal betrothal and for Simon to come north. After a while, she began to think about him a great deal, and she looked forward to seeing him again. Kristin was now grown up, and she was exceedingly beautiful. She most resembled her father. She was tall and small-waisted, with slender, elegant limbs, but she was also buxom and shapely. Her face was rather short and round, her forehead low and broad and as white as milk, her eyes large, gray, and gentle under finely etched brows. Her mouth was a little too big, but her full lips were a fresh red, and her chin was round like an apple and nicely shaped. She had lovely, thick, long hair, but it was rather dark now, more brown than gold, and quite straight. Lavrans liked nothing better than to hear Sira Eirik boast about Kristin. The priest had watched the maiden grow up, had taught her reading and writing, and was very fond of her. But Lavrans was not particularly pleased to hear the priest occasionally compare his daughter to a flawless and glossy-coated young mare. Yet everyone said that if the accident had not befallen Ulvil, she would have been many times more beautiful than her sister. She had the prettiest and sweetest face, white and pink like roses and lilies, with white-gold, silky soft hair that flowed and curled around her slender neck and thin shoulders. Her eyes resembled those of the Yesling family. They were deep-set beneath straight black brows, and they were as clear as water and grayish-blue, but her gaze was gentle, not sharp. The child's voice was also so clear and lovely that it was a joy to listen to her whether she spoke or sang. She had an agile talent for book-learning and for playing all types of stringed instruments and board games, but she took little interest in needlework because her back would quickly tire. It seemed unlikely that this pretty child would ever regain the full health of her body, although she improved somewhat after her parents took her to Nidaros to the shrine of St. Olaf. Lavrans and Ronfrid went there on foot without a single servant or maid to accompany them, and they carried the child on a litter between them for the entire journey. After that, Ulvil was so much better that she could walk with a crutch. But it was not likely that she would ever be well enough to marry, and so, when the time came, she would probably be sent to a convent with all the possessions that she would inherit. They never talked about it, and Ulvil was not aware that she was any different from other children. She was very fond of finery and beautiful clothes, and her parents didn't have the heart to refuse her anything. Ronfrid stitched and sewed for her and adorned her like a royal child. Once some peddlers came through the village and stayed the night at Laugarbru, where Ulvil was allowed to examine their wares. They had some amber-yellow silk, and she was set on having a shift made from it. Lavrans normally never traded with the kind of people who traveled through the villages, illegally selling goods from the town, but this time he bought the entire bolt at once. He also gave Kristin cloth for her bridal shift, which she worked on during the summer. Before that, she had never owned shifts made of anything but wool, except for a linen shift for her finest gown. But Ulvil was given a shift made of silk to wear to banquets, and a Sunday shift of linen with a bodice of silk. Lavrans Björgolfsson now owned Laugarbrú as well, which was tended by Tortoise and Jan. Lavrans and Ranfrid's youngest daughter Romborg lived with them there. Tortoise had been her wet nurse. Ranfrid would hardly even look at the child during the first days after her birth, because she said that she brought her children bad luck. And yet she loved the little maiden dearly and was constantly sending gifts to her and to Tortoise. Later on, she would often go over to Laugarbrú to visit Romborg, but she preferred to arrive after the child was asleep, and then she would sit with her. Lavrans and the two older daughters often went to Laugarbrú to play with the little one. She was a strong and healthy child, though not as pretty as her sisters. That summer was the last one that Arne Geirdsson spent at Jurengard. The bishop had promised Geird to help the boy make his way in the world, and in the fall, Arne was to leave for Hamar. Kristin had undoubtedly noticed that Arne was fond of her, but in many ways her feelings were quite childish, so she didn't give it much thought and behaved toward him as she always had, ever since they were children. She sought out his company as often as she could and always took his hand when they danced at home or on the church hill. The fact that her mother didn't approve of this, she found rather amusing. But she never spoke to Arne about Simon or about her betrothal, for she noticed that he grew dispirited whenever it was mentioned. Arne was good with his hands, and he wanted to make Kristin a sewing chest to remember him by. He had carved an elegant and beautiful box and frame, and now he was working in the smithy to make iron bands and a lock for it. On a fine evening with fair weather late in the summer, Kristin went over to talk to him. She took along one of her father's shirts to mend, sat down on the stone doorstep, and began to sew as she chatted with a young man inside the smithy. Ulvil was with her too, hopping around on her crutch and eating raspberries that were growing among the stones piled up on the ground. After a while, Arne came over to the smithy door to cool off. He wanted to sit down next to Kristin, but she moved away a bit and asked him to take care not to get soot on the sewing that she was holding on her lap. "So that's how things have become between us," said Arne. "You don't dare let me sit with you because you're afraid that the farm boy will get you dirty?" Kristin looked at him in surprise and then said, "You know quite well what I meant. But take off your apron, wash the coal from your hands, and sit down here with me and rest a while." And she made room for him. But Arne lay down in the grass in front of her. Then Kristin continued, "Now don't be angry, dear Arne. Do you think I would be so ungrateful for the lovely present that you're making for me? Or that I would ever forget that you've always been my best friend here at home?"
"Have I been?" he asked.
"You know you have," said Kristin. "And I'll never forget you. But you, who are about to go out into the world, maybe you'll acquire wealth and honor before you know it. You'll probably forget me long before I forget you."
"You'll never forget me," said Arne and smiled. "But I'll forget you before you forget me. You're such a child, Kristin."
"You're not very old yourself," she replied.
"I'm just as old as Simon Dare," he said. "And we can bear helmets and shields just as well as the different people. But my parents have not had fortune on their side."
He had wiped off his hands on some tufts of grass. Now he took hold of Kristen's ankle and pressed his cheek against her foot, which was sticking out from the hem of her dress. She tried to pull her foot away, but Arne said,
"Your mother is at Laugarbrú, and Lavrans rode off from the farm. And from the buildings, no one can see us sitting here. Just this once, you must let me talk about what's on my mind."
Kristin replied, "We've always known, both you and I, that it would be futile for us to fall in love with each other."
"Can I put my head in your lap?" asked Arne. And when she didn't reply, he did it anyway, wrapping his arm around her waist.
With the other hand, he tugged on her braids.
"How will you like it," he asked after a moment, "when Simon lies in your lap like this and plays with your hair?"
Kristen didn't answer. She felt as if a weight suddenly fell upon her. Arna's words and Arna's head on her knees. It seemed to her as if a door were opening into a room with many dark corridors leading into more darkness. Unhappy and heartsick, she hesitated, refusing to look inside.
"Married people don't do things like this," she said abruptly and briskly, as if with relief.
She tried to imagine Simon's plump, round face looking up at her with the same gaze in his eyes as Arna now had. She heard his voice, and she couldn't help laughing.
"I don't think Simon would ever lie down on the ground to play with my shoes."
"No, because he can play with you in his own bed," said Arna.
His voice made Kristen feel suddenly sick and helpless. She tried to push his head off her lap, but he pressed it harder against her knees and said gently,
"But I would play with your shoes and your hair and your fingers and follow you in and out all day long, Kristen, if you would be my wife and sleep in my arms every night."
He pulled himself halfway up, put his hands on her shoulders, and looked into her eyes.
"It's not proper for you to talk to me this way," said Kristen quietly and shyly.
"No, it's not," said Arna.
He got to his feet and stood in front of her.
"But tell me one thing. Wouldn't you rather it had been me?"
"Oh, I would rather..."
She sat in silence for a moment.
"I would rather not have any man at all. Not even..."
Arna didn't move. He said,
"Would you rather go into a convent then, as they've planned for Ulvil, and be a maiden all your days?"
Kristen wrung her hands in her lap. She felt a strange, sweet trembling inside her. And with a sudden shudder, she realized how sad it was for her little sister. And her eyes filled with tears of sorrow for Ulvild's sake.
"Kristen," said Arna gently.
At that moment, Ulvil screamed loudly. Her crutch had lodged between some stones and she had fallen. Arna and Kristen ran over to her, and Arna lifted her into her sister's arms. She had cut her mouth and was bleeding badly. Kristen sat down with her in the doorway to the smithy, and Arna brought water in a wooden bowl. Together, they began to wash Ulvil's face. She had also scraped the skin on her knees. Kristen bent tenderly over the small, thin legs. Ulvil's wailing soon stopped, and she whimpered softly, the way children do who are used to suffering pain. Kristen pressed Ulvil's head against her breast and rocked her gently. Then the bell up in Olav's church began ringing for vespers. Arna spoke to Kristen, but she sat there as if she neither heard nor sensed what he said as she bent over her sister. Then he grew frightened and asked her whether she thought the injuries were serious. Kristen shook her head, but refused to look at him. A little later, she stood up and started walking toward the farm, carrying Ulvil in her arms. Arna followed, silent and confused. Kristen looked so preoccupied that her face was completely rigid. As she walked, the bell continued to toll across the meadows and valley. It was still ringing as she went into the house. She placed Ulvil on the bed which the sisters had shared ever since Kristen had grown too old to sleep with her parents. Then she took off her own shoes and lay down next to the little one. She lay there and listened for the bell long after it had stopped ringing and the child was asleep. It had occurred to her, as the bell began to peal, while she sat with Ulvil's little bloodied face in her hands, that perhaps this was an omen for her. If she would take her sister's place, if she would promise herself to the service of God and the Virgin Mary, then maybe God would grant the child renewed vigor and good health. Kristen remembered Brother Edvin saying that these days parents offered to God only the crippled and lame children, or those for whom they could not arrange good marriages. She knew her parents were pious people, and yet she had never heard them say anything except that she would marry. But when they realized that Ulvil would be ill all her days, they at once proposed that she should enter a convent. but Kristin didn't want to do it. She resisted the idea that God would perform a miracle for Ulvil if she became a nun. She clung to Sira Eirik's words that so few miracles occurred nowadays. And yet she had the feeling this evening that it was as Brother Edvin had said, that if someone had enough faith, then he could indeed work miracles. But she did not want that kind of faith. She did not love God and his mother and the saints in that way. She would never love them in that way. She loved the world and longed for the world. Kristin pressed her lips to Ulvil's soft, silky hair. The child slept soundly, but the elder sister sat up, restless, and then lay down again. Her heart was bleeding with sorrow and shame, but she knew that she could not believe in miracles because she was unwilling to give up her inheritance of health and beauty and love. Then she tried to console herself with the thought that her parents would never give her permission to do such a thing, nor would they ever believe that it would do any good. She was already betrothed, after all, and they would undoubtedly be loath to lose Simon, whom they liked so much. She felt betrayed because they seemed to find this son-in-law so splendid. She suddenly thought with displeasure of Simon's round, red face and his small, laughing eyes, of his leaping gait. It occurred to her all of a sudden that he bounced like a ball, and of his teasing manner of speaking, which made her feel awkward and stupid. And it was not such a splendid thing, either, to be given to him and then move only as far as Formo. And yet she would rather have him than be sent to a convent. But what about the world beyond the mountains, the king's castle, and the counts and the knights that Fru Asild had talked about, a handsome man with melancholy eyes who would follow her in and out and never grow tired? She remembered Arna on that summer day long ago, when he lay on his side and slept with his shiny brown hair spread out on the heath. She had loved him as if he were her own brother back then. It wasn't proper for him to speak to her the way he had today, when he knew they could never have each other. Word was sent from Laugarbrú that her mother would stay there overnight. Kristin got up to undress and get ready for bed. She began to unlace her dress, but then she put her shoes back on, wrapped her cloak around her, and went out. The night sky, bright and green, stretched above the mountain crests. It was almost time for the moon to rise, and at the spot where it waited below the ridge, small clouds drifted past, gleaming like silver underneath. The sky grew lighter and lighter, like metal gathering dew. Kristin ran between the fences, across the road, and up the hill toward the church. It was asleep, black and locked, but she went over to the cross that stood nearby, a memorial to the time when St. Olav once rested there as he was fleeing from his enemies. Kristin knelt down on the stone and placed her folded hands on the base. "Holy cross, the strongest of masts, the fairest of trees, the bridge for those who are ill to the fair shores of health." As she spoke the words of the prayer, she felt her yearning gradually spread like rings on water. The various thoughts that were making her uneasy were smoothed out. Her mind grew calmer, more tender, and a gentle sorrow, empty of all thought, replaced her troubles. She stayed there on her knees, aware of all the sounds of the night. The wind was sighing so oddly, the river was roaring beyond the groves on the other side of the church, and the stream was flowing nearby, right across the road. And everywhere, both close at hand and far away in the dark, her eyes and her ears caught hints of tiny rivulets of running and dripping water. The river flashed white down in the village. The moon glided up over a small gap in the mountains. Stones and leaves wet with dew shimmered faintly, and the newly tarred timbers of the bell tower near the cemetery gate shone dull and dark. Then the moon vanished again where the ridge of the mountain rose higher. Many more gleaming white clouds appeared in the sky. She heard a horse approaching at a slow pace higher up the road. and the sound of men's voices, speaking evenly and softly. Kristen was not afraid of people so close to home, where she knew everyone. She felt quite safe. Her father's dogs came rushing toward her, turned around and bounded back to the grove, then turned again and raced back to her. Then her father called a greeting as he emerged from among the birches. He was leading Guldsvine by the bridle. A bunch of birds dangled in front of the saddle, and Lavrans was carrying a hooded hawk on his left hand. He was in the company of a tall, hunchbacked man in monk's clothing. And before Kristen had even seen his face, she knew it was Brother Edvin. She went to greet them, and she couldn't have been more surprised than if she had dreamed it. She merely smiled when Lavrans asked her whether she recognized their guest. Lavrans had met the monk up by Rost Bridge. Then he had persuaded him to come home with him and stay the night at the farm. But Brother Edvin insisted on being allowed to sleep in the cowshed. "For I've picked up so many lice that you can't have me lying in your good beds." And no matter how much Lavrans begged and implored, the monk was adamant. At first, he even wanted them to bring his food out into the courtyard. But finally they coaxed him inside the house, and Kristen put wood in the fireplace in the corner and set candles on the table, while a maid brought in food and drink. The monk sat down on the beggar's bench near the door, but he would only take cold porridge and water for his evening meal. And he refused to accept Lavran's offer to prepare a bath for him and to have his clothes washed. Brother Edvin scratched and rubbed himself, and his gaunt old face beamed with glee. "No, no," he said. "The lice bite better at my proud hide than any scourges or the guardian's words. I spent this summer under an overhang up on the mountain. They had given me permission to go into the wilderness to fast and pray, and there I sat, thinking that I was as pure as a holy hermit, and the poor people over in Setna Valley brought food up to me and thought they beheld a pious monk living a pure life. 'Brother Edvin,' they said, 'if there were more monks like you, then we would soon mend our ways. But when we see priests and bishops and monks shoving and fighting like piglets at the trough, well,' I told them that was not a Christian way to talk. But I liked hearing it all the same. And I sang and prayed so my voice resounded in the mountains. Now it will be to my benefit to feel how the lice are biting and fighting on my skin, and to hear the good housewives, who want to keep their houses clean and neat, shouting that the filthy monk hide can just as well sleep in the barn during the summer. I'm heading north to Nidaros now, to celebrate St. Olav's Day, and it will do me good to see that people aren't so keen to come near me." Ulvil woke up. Then Lavrans went over and lifted her up in his cape. "Here is the child I told you about, dear father. Place your hands on her and pray to God for her, the way you prayed for the boy up north in Meldal. We heard he regained his health." The monk gently put his hand under Ulvil's chin and looked into her eyes. Then he lifted one of her hands and kissed it. "You should pray instead, you and your wife, Lavrans Bjørgelsen, that you will not be tempted to bend God's will with this child. Our Lord Jesus himself has set these small feet on a path so that she can walk safely toward the house of peace. I can see in your eyes, blessed Ulvia, that you have your intercessors in that other house. I heard that the boy in Meldal got well," said Lavrans quietly. "He was the only child of a poor widow, and there was no one to feed or clothe him when the mother passed away, except the village. And yet, the woman only asked that God give her a fearless heart so that she might have faith that he would let happen whatever was best for the boy. I did nothing more than pray alongside her." "It's not easy for Ronfrid and me to be content with that," said Lavrans gloomily, "especially since she's so pretty and so good. Have you seen the child they have over in Lidsta, in the south of the valley?" asked the monk. "Would you rather your daughter were like that?" Lavrans shuddered and pressed the child close. "Don't you think
Brother Edvin went on, that in God's eyes, we are all like children for whom he has reason to grieve, crippled as we are by sin. And yet we don't think that things are the worst in the world for us. He walked over to the painting of the Virgin Mary on the wall, and everyone knelt down as he said the evening prayer. They felt that Brother Edvin had offered them great comfort. But after he had left the house to find his sleeping place, Ostrey, who was in charge of all the maids, vigorously swept the floor everywhere the monk had stood and hastily threw the sweepings into the fire. The next morning, Kristen got up early, put some milk porridge and wheat cakes into a lovely red-flecked bowl made from birch roots, for she knew that the monk never touched meat, and took the food out to him. No one else in the house was awake yet. Brother Edvin was standing on the ramp to the cowshed, ready to leave, with his staff and bag in hand. With a smile, he thanked Kristen for her trouble and sat down in the grass and ate, while Kristen sat at his feet. Her little white dog came running over to them, making the tiny bells on his collar ring. Kristen pulled the dog onto her lap, and Brother Edvin snapped his fingers, tossing little bits of wheat cake into the dog's mouth as he praised the animal. "It's the same breed that Queen Euphemia brought over to Norway," he said. "Everything is so splendid here at Uhrengard now." Kristen blushed with pleasure. She knew the dog was particularly fine, and she was proud to own him. No one else in the village had a pet dog. But she hadn't known that he was of the same type as the queen's pet dogs.
"Simon Andresen sent him to me," she said, hugging the dog as he licked her face. "His name is Cortelyn."
She had planned to speak to the monk about her uneasiness and ask for his advice. But now she had no wish to spend any more time on her thoughts of the night before. Brother Edvin believed that God would do what was best for Ulil. And it was generous of Simon to send her such a gift, even before their betrothal had been formally acknowledged. She refused to think about Arna. He had behaved badly toward her, she thought. Brother Edvin picked up his staff and bag and asked Kristen to give his greetings to the others. He wouldn't wait for everyone to wake up, but would set off while the day was cool. She walked with him up past the church and a short way into the grove. When they parted, he offered her God's peace and blessed her.
"Give me a few words, as you did for Ulvil, dear father," begged Kristen as she stood with her hand in his.
The monk poked his bare foot, knotty with rheumatism, in the wet grass.
"Then I would impress upon your heart, my daughter, that you should pay close attention to the way God tends to the welfare of the people here in the valley. Little rain falls, but he has given you water from the mountains, and the dew refreshes the meadows and fields each night. Thank God for the good gifts he has given you, and don't complain if you think you are lacking something else that you think would be beneficial. You have beautiful golden hair, so do not fret because it isn't curly. Haven't you heard about the woman who sat and wept because she had only a little scrap of pork to give to her 7 hungry children for Christmas dinner? Saint Olav came riding past at that very moment. Then he stretched out his hand over the meat and prayed to God to feed the poor urchins. But when the woman saw that a slaughtered pig lay on the table, she began to cry, because she didn't have enough bowls and pots.
Kristen ran off toward home, and Cortelyn danced around her at her feet as he nipped at her clothing and barked, making all his tiny silver bells ring. Chapter 6 Arna was home at Finnsbrekken for the last time before he left for Hamar. His mother and sisters were outfitting him with clothes. The day before he was supposed to ride south, he went to Uhrengard to say farewell. There he asked Kristen in a whisper whether she would meet him on the road south of Laugarbru on the following evening.
"I would like us to be alone, just the two of us, the last time we meet," he said. "Do you think that's too much to ask?"
We who have grown up together as brother and sister, he added, when Kristen hesitated a moment before replying. Then she promised to come if she could slip away from home. The next morning it snowed, but later in the day it began to rain, and soon the roads and fields were nothing but gray mud. Wisps of fog hovered and drifted along the mountain ridges, occasionally dropping down and twining into white mist at the foot of the mountains. But then the weather closed in again. Sarah Eirik came over to help Lavrans put together several boxes of letters. They went into the hearth house because it was more comfortable there in that kind of weather than in the larger house where the fireplace filled the room with smoke. Ronfrid was at Laugarbru, where Romborg was recuperating from an illness and fever she had suffered earlier that fall. So it was not difficult for Kristen to slip away from the farm unnoticed. She didn't dare take a horse, so she went on foot. The road was a morass of slushy snow and withered leaves. The air smelled mournfully raw and dead and moldy. And now and then a gust of wind would blow the rain right into her face. Kristen pulled her hood up over her head and held her cloak closed with both hands as she walked briskly onward. She was a little apprehensive. The clamor of the river sounded so muffled in the oppressive air, and the clouds were black and ragged, drifting above the mountain crests. Occasionally she would stop and listen behind her, thinking that she might hear Arna. After a while she became aware of a horse's hooves on the sodden road, and then she stopped, for she had reached a rather desolate spot and thought it would be a suitable place for them to say goodbye to each other undisturbed. A moment later she saw the rider appear behind her, and Arna jumped down from his horse, leading it forward as he walked toward her. It was good of you to come, he said, in this awful weather.
It's worse for you, who will have to ride such a long way. But why are you leaving so late in the evening?
Jon has invited me to stay at Lopsgard tonight, said Arna. And I thought it would be easier for you to come here at this time of day.
They stood in silence for a moment. Kristen thought she had never before realized how handsome Arna was. He wore a shiny steel helmet, and under it, a brown woolen hood that framed his face and spread out over his shoulders. Underneath, his thin face looked so bright and fair. His leather breastplate was old, flecked with rust, and scratched from the coat of mail that had been worn over it. Arna's father had given it to him, but it fit snugly on his slender, lithe, and strong body. He wore a sword at his side and carried a spear in his hand. His other weapons hung from his saddle. He was a full-grown man and looked imposing. Kristen put her hand on his shoulder and said, "Do you remember, Arna, that you once asked me whether I thought you were as splendid a fellow as Simon Andersen? I want to tell you something now before we part. You seem to me as much his superior in fair appearance and bearing as he is held above you in birth and wealth by people who value such things most."
"Why are you telling me this?" asked Arna breathlessly.
"Because Brother Edvin impressed on my heart that we should thank God for his good gifts and not be like the woman who wept because she had no bowls when St. Olav multiplied the meat for her. So you shouldn't fret over the fact that he hasn't given you as much wealth as he has physical gifts."
"Is that what you meant?" said Arna. And when Kristen didn't reply, he went on, "I was wondering whether you meant that you would rather have been married to me than to that other man."
"I probably would at that," she said quietly, "for I know you much better."
Arna threw his arms around her so tight that he lifted her feet off the ground. He kissed her face many times, but then he set her down. "God help us, Kristen. You're such a child." She stood there with her head bowed, but she kept her hands on his shoulders. He gripped her wrists and held them tight. "I see now that you don't realize, my sweet, how my heart aches because I'm going to lose you. Kristen, we've grown up together like two apples on a branch. I loved you before I began to realize that one day someone else would come and tear you away from me. As certain as God had to die for us all, I don't know how I can ever be happy again in this world after today. Kristen wept bitterly and lifted her face so that he could kiss her.